Gilbert would bring a new idea. We'd share it as a group. We'd toss it around. Coaches, particularly in Steve's time, he'd look really closely about how that could link with the actual playing performance and how we could inspire, motivate, and bring people with him. So I think one of the things we also learned is that don't search for silver bullets. Try and have a bulletproof plan.
Tēnā koutou katoa nau mai hoki mai ki talking performance. Ko Jay Carter aho. I tērā nei e kōrero ana au, kia Darren Shand. Welcome back or welcome to Talking Performance. This week, I'm so excited to be joined by Darren Shand. Darren has been the All Black manager for about the last 20 years, and in this chat, we go in depth behind the scenes about what it means to be an All Black manager. I'm sure you'll enjoy this chat. If you do, as always, it'd be wicked if you could share it with your mates. So today I'm pretty excited to have with me Darren Shand. Darren, there's two things I think. One is that you should be famous for being the All Blacks manager for the last 20 years, but you've kept a relatively low profile in such a high profile position, which is something I actually appreciate. But hopefully now we get to hear a bit about Darren Shand, the man, and the work that you did. But before we get into that space, I'd love to know a little bit about your background. I have read a little bit, and I understand that rugby wasn't necessarily your first love. You're a pretty useful cricketer, and I want to say represented New Zealand at under 21 level in hockey, and then went to Otago, Bachelor of PE, and
yes.
Carried on. So, yeah, fill us in a little bit on your early days.
Brought up in Hastings, in the mighty Hawke's Bay.
The other bay.
Love the Magpies. I played just your typical Kiwi kid, played all sport. Tennis and cricket took up the summers, rugby and hockey. The winters, got to about 13 with rugby and my hockey career was going places, so... ditched the rugby. Did well with cricket here and loved that game. And I had the great pleasure of the school I was at. We had the two Cooper brothers, Matthew and Greg, school. So that was pretty cool. We had Greg was a very good cricketer, amazing, and Matthew was super talented as well. So enjoyed that. Probably from about age 12. I remember a guy coming into our school. He was studying at Otago University, and he could just play all sports. And I was like, "Oh well, this guy, he's it, you know." And so I thought, oh, "I'm going to be a phys ed teacher. That's all I ever imagined doing." And so I went down to Dunedin, and my first year, I did the sort of intermediate teaching paper. And I think towards the end of that year, we had to sort of like plan our first lesson plan, and we got sent out to an Otago school. And I got Otago Girls High, and I got one of the lowest stream classes. And I had a 45-minute lesson, and I couldn't get out of the changing rooms for the first 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, I'm not built for this, you know. And so I kind of completely restructured my degree and went more down the science side and the sort of social side, psychology, recreation, tourism, all those sort of things. And when I got to uni, yeah, you're right. I'd made the New Zealand under 23 hockey team in my last year at school. And I was just putting everything into hockey. I was loving it. Made that team in my last year at school, which really surprised me. Like playing for Hawke's Bay, we weren't sort of one of the big sides. But and I don't know if I was ready for it, you know. Like that last year at school was just – I had that. I played for the Hawke's Bay men's team that year. We – somehow ended up in the semi-finals of the national champs, and we ended up playing Auckland in the semi-finals, and I was marking a guy called Ramesh Patel, Olympic gold medal winner, former CEO of New Zealand Hockey, and it was like one of those, oh wow. we lost, but we ended up third, which I think the best Hawke's Bay had ever done. And then I went down to Dunedin from Hawke's Bay, and it was all so different. Suddenly I was on my own. Had a mentor in Hawke's Bay that I trained with all the time. He wasn't there. The coaching style was different, lifestyle was different. I was so hooked on my hockey, I didn't even get into O Week or anything. You know, I was just I wanted to get into that team again the next year, the under 23s. And I went to the Nationals with the Otago team. They weren't particularly strong. The coach decided to change me from a right side player to a left side player, which completely threw me off my game. My grandfather died that week of that tournament, and we finished the tournament. It was a year when there was going to be a Junior World Cup. And that was like the thing, you know, to go overseas with the Silver Fern. And I ended up being a non-travelling reserve.
It just
gutted me. I went back down to Dunedin. I just couldn't face playing club hockey in the cold. And I saw the season out with the university club. And towards the end of that, of my second year at uni in phys ed school, there was a skiing practical course. And so I went on it, and I just like fell in love straight away. And so I just, dropped the hockey stick, never picked it up again. And probably spent 4 days a week in Queenstown every winter while I finished my degree off. My entry into Queenstown then was, I went, attempted my ski instructor's exams as soon as I arrived in Queenstown, and thought, I'm going to need a summer job. And all that rafting, I'd done a bit of whitewater kayaking at university as well, so the rafting sort of appealed. I had a couple of friends from Hawke's Bay working down there, so I just threw myself into it down there, got my bus license while I was in Dunedin, learned on the suburban buses, because if you had a bus license, you could carry paying passengers anywhere, you know. Literally within a couple of weeks of arriving in Queenstown, I was driving trailers of rafts into the Skipper's Canyon.
And
within a couple of months, I was a guide. And then the winters I taught skiing. And sort of through that journey, I didn't realize how much I actually learned until later when I reflected on it. But we'd go out to the river on days, and we'd have, international guests. Rafting was probably the big adventure activity back in the late 80s, early 90s. I think the company I was working for were taking about 50,000 people a year down the river. It was big numbers. So it wasn't, bungee hadn't started. Jet boating was quite a big thing, but all these things you got down there now didn't even exist, like paraponting or zip lining, or none of that stuff existed. Skydiving, it was just basically rafting, skiing and jet boating. So we were sort of the big dogs of town, And I loved it, but there was a lot of risk, huge risk. And it wasn't until there was a couple of events that really changed things for me. One, the river changed one year. A massive rock fell into this big rapid, and it pretty much meant every time we went through this rapid, the odds of getting through it went from sort of like 90% safely to 50% safely. And so people were just getting trashed, And then I did a trip one winter, the start of winter, myself and another guy from our company, and because it's winter, there was a regulation you needed everybody to be together for safety. It was pretty cold down there in June on the river. And it was a shortened trip too. You just did a short section of the river, so you flew in by chopper and did about 40 minutes on the river. But I came into this rapid behind the other company's rafts, and I dropped in this rapid called the toilet, and there was a leg sticking up in the middle of the river, on the side of the river. And the raft in front of me had hit something. It bounced off this rock, and she was a woman, had fallen in the river. And she was stuck, underwater. So we pulled in the bottom, myself and the other guy with our company. We ran up to get her, and just as we got there, because we could see the other guy, the banks were icy. You could see the other guys were actually trying to set up a line to get themselves down there safely. We just sort of stuff it. We don't have time here. We just got to scramble. Just as we got to, she popped out. So we both dived in, got her to the shore, and she was blue, she'd probably been 15 minutes underwater.
Oh, no.
So we did CPR, my hands were so cold I could never even, wouldn't have known if I could have felt her pulse or not. And then eventually we got we had radios and we got a helicopter in and a doctor. It took a long time, like an hour, I think, we did CPR for. Meanwhile, four boats of people are sitting there right in front of us watching it all, friends. She was a young 21-year-old Australian girl, part of a Contiki, the 18 to 35 Contiki tours.
Yeah.
And then the doctor arrived. He just got the torch out, pulled her eyes and asked, she's done, boys, hard luck. I was like, great bedside manner.
Yeah.
And then they just took her and took off, and we're like there with all these people, and we've still got half the river to do, Anyway, got back and was a real defining moment for me and this other guy, because we just, our training's just not good enough. You know, we don't have the resources. So we set off and started doing some courses up and found these American guides working in Christchurch. So when, and they have this thing over in America called the Swiftwater Rescue, which is kind of like paramedics training. So we went and did that. And we brought it back to our boss and said, hey, you know, we need all this stuff. We need resources at the river. An hour to get a chop is way too long. We're taking people down the river that aren't up to it, you know, taking people that are obese, that couldn't even get the life jacket on properly. And I said, this isn't Disneyland, mate. This is like, this is real, you know. And then with that rapid and more people falling out, and my last season, myself and the same guy who had been there with the death, we ran the training program for the company. So it's October, we'd get 30 boys arrive, we'd take them on the river for 2 weeks every day, out there learning, teaching, pretty much giving them paramedic training, the whole nine yards. And we went to pick up our pay after the second week, and I said to Fred, the other guy, I said, what'd you get paid, bro? And he goes, oh, yeah, I don't know if I got all the daily rate. I said, no, me neither. And so we went to see the boss, and it had been a quiet start to the spring, and so not everyone was working. And in those days, it was you were paid per trip, you know, so you only got paid for the work you did. And he'd only given us 75% of the daily rate. He said, oh, I've just guaranteed you 2 weeks' work, and if you were on the normal roster, you would have only worked 3 days a week. I said, okay. I just took my jacket off, handed it to him, said, I'm out. See ya. Walked out. I'd had enough, you know, like I just didn't. There's so much happening on the river. The following summer, there was 4 deaths.
Oh, wow.
And one of the directors of that company got held, who's a good friend of mine, got held accountable for negligence. Oh. And anyway, I went down the road, and one of my early customers rafting was a guy called AJ Hackett.
Yeah, right.
Bookham rafting. And, yeah, AJ's a super person. Like, just, you should get him on your podcast. He's got a great New Zealand story.
Yeah, I bet he has.
High performance. Yeah. No one died when he was there. But, yeah, he went up to him, and he always said to me, if you want to come and help work with us, you know, put your hand up. So I went to him and said, oh, AJ, I've done with rafting. Can you give me a job? He goes, well, you know, we've got a pretty full roster, but there is a job driving the bus out to the bridge every day. I said, I'll take it. So I shifted off to him, and he let me keep my skiing job in the winters. Eventually I ended up working on the bridge. After about 3 years, he offered me a management position. So it was kind of the first time I'd stepped from being a worker to actually, you know, having some responsibility, accountability, and leading people. And it was a marketing and sales role. So that kind of got to the point where got to my 30s, and I was like, oh, what am I doing here? This is just, it's fun, but, you know, where am I going, you know? And I could see some, you know, I was working with some ski instructors at Coronet Peak that were like 55, and that's all they'd done their life, you know. I had a raft guide with me who was in his 50s, and that's all he'd done all his life. And I was like, I'm better than that. You know, not disrespectfully better, but I think I've got more in me than that.
Yeah.
I thought about going and doing an MBA at that stage. Actually got to the point of applying to do it at Otago, and there's an entry exam, did that, got accepted. But then at that time saw this opportunity with Canterbury Rugby. So, just applied. It was a commercial role. And somehow I've convinced Steve Chu, who was the CEO at the time, and another guy who's been in rugby a long time in the commercial area, a guy called Warren Goddard. Those two were sort of the pair that had started the whole dynasty of Canterbury from the business side. And, yeah, got a job with them. And I moved into my office on the first day, and it was like an open plan house at Lancaster Park. Sharing a room with Steve Hansen and Robbie Deans.
Oh, nice.
So it was full imposter syndrome, overwhelm to start with.
Yeah.
But, so I worked in Warren's area for a while commercially, cold calling, you know, trying to sell commercial packages, looking after all the team's apparel, the interactions with sponsors, with the players. And after I think the end of 98, Robbie came up to me and just said, how would you like to manage the Canterbury NPC team? I said, oh, well, Robbie, I never played rugby to any great extent. I've never managed a team in my life, so why do you think I can do it? And he said, I think it'd be good. You know, we've been watching how you interact with the players around outfitting and how you manage them with the promotional work. And at that time, Robbie was the manager of the Crusaders. because Wayne Smith was coaching the Crusaders in 98-99. And so, yeah, just jumped on board in 99 as a manager of the Canterbury NPC team. I kept my commercial jobs. So I kind of managed to do both for a while. And then at the end of that year, Smithy got made All Black coach. And so he left the Crusaders. Robbie became the head coach with Steve Hansen. And Robbie goes, oh, well, you may as well just join the Crusaders now. And you've done a good job with the NPC team. And Steve and I are now coaching the Crusaders. So let's pull the team together. So, yeah, that was the start.
Nice. So what does it involve? Like, you know, the manager role, there's some assumptions around it, but what is it, what your core duty for, say, Crusaders, and then I guess is it different again at All Black level and over, I guess, as we go on, the time change?
Yeah, I guess traditionally my very first mentor was a guy called John Sturgeon. So John was the All Black manager when Chris Wiley was a coach. Wonderful man from Renunga on the West Coast. He was the supervisor of the mines, I think. So, yeah, pretty straight shooter. He said, you know, all you really got to worry about is make sure the jerseys are there and there's enough beer in the sheds afterwards. I think initially in those early days, because this is just as the game went professional, I say 96 it went pro, this is 98, 2000, around that period. So there was just that kind of shift. I took over from a board member with the Canterbury team. So it used to be a position that was sort of ex officio. And in a way, without being disrespectful, it was kind of the dog's body job. You just picked up everything and organized everything. It was a very functional role. But as professional rugby grew, there was a whole lot of other, I guess, business constraints that, you know, sort of became a big part of the role. Fast forward to the All Black role in 2004. The end of the Mitchell era. I don't know if you remember, there was the All Black manager for most of John Mitchell's period was a guy called Andrew Martin, the former head of the New Zealand SAS, and the Colonel, as he was known. And he was probably a little ahead of his time. Like he saw himself as a general manager, and I think that's what the union wanted from him. But he certainly did it in a military style, which didn't resonate with everybody. And so I think in the end he departed just before the World Cup in 03 and they put someone temporarily in. And so come the end of that campaign, which, you know, they dropped out in the semis, I think, and Jock Hobbs was the chair at the time. There'd been a whole lot of things happen off field the board didn't feel were that great. So they kind of repositioned the position and they effectively said the new All Black manager will be the general manager of the team. So the coach will report to him. And he will look after everything and build his team with the coach. So, yeah, put my hand up, had a crack at the job. Interestingly, I was not sure whether I wanted to do it because as soon as it was made public, that was the role. You know, people speculate as they do in the media, you know. Is it going to be Andy Dalton? Is it going to be Sean Fitzpatrick? You know, is it going to be Andy Hayden? Certainly not Darren Hu. And so I actually rang the panel and said, how's this going to roll? What are you looking for? You know, I said, I don't want to waste your time or my time. You know, I've got a good job here at the Crusaders. I'm enjoying the environment. Still feel like I'm learning, but you know, what do you want? And they were very clear, like, we want to, you know, advance this role. We're really looking for someone that's got the runs on the board, been in the environments, done it, can look at the rest of everything off field and let the coaches focus on the on field, but we need all the rest of the off field stuff to be given its light and be embedded into the program, if you like, you know, because commercial was growing, the requirement for media was growing, all those other things. So, went through the interviews and at the very last one, the chairman of the panel said to me, oh, I want to make an apology. I said, oh, well, what's that for? He said, well, yeah, unfortunately, did you read the paper today? And I said no, and he said it's been leaked. You know who the final three candidates are. You know, Andy Hayden, Andy Dalton, and Darren Hoop. And so we're sitting there. I thought, right, this is my moment. You know, this is my moment. And so I said to them, well, gentlemen, now that you've confirmed who the other two candidates are, can I take you back to that conversation we had? Before I applied for this job, and you made it really clear to me what you were looking for. So what you've now confirmed is that Both the other candidates have never managed a professional sporting team before. Yes, they have a lot of other credentials as people and a lot of experience with this team, but what you told me what you were looking for was what I have to offer. So do I have the job? And I could just feel like the sweat running down my back.
Yeah.
Oh, man, have I blown it? But it was just, you know that, I know you've been in that situation where you have that deathly silence, you know? And I thought, no. So nothing was said, so I just looked at, I guess we've finished today, have we? So it was sort of a nod, so I walked out. And I remember sitting in the lobby of this hotel in Wellington thinking, oh, man, what have I done here, you know? Got this part, you know? soon the panel walked out. And one of the panel was this amazing man, DJ Graham, Sir John Graham. And John saw things very black and white, you know? And John was a caring man, but he liked authority and he liked decisiveness, you know? And he just walked past me and he gave me this big wink and a smile.
Yeah.
And that gave me a little bit of hope, you know? And so later that day I got the job and started. And then my challenge was, oh, I'm working with Graham Henry. He's old enough to be my dad. And he's done everything in rugby and who am I, you know? But we sat down in a restaurant in Christchurch one day and I said, oh, what do you want, Ted? You know? And he said, I just want to coach, Darren. I want you to sort out all the other stuff. I said, oh, can we do that, you know, like hand in hand? I said, because I don't want to be your boss. I just want to work with you, you know? And that was it. And he very quickly brought on Steve and Wayne. And when I think about leadership now, I admire Graham so much for doing that. Like who would be brave enough to bring two coaches into their environment that are actually probably better coaches than him? Like, who does that?
Yeah.
You know, and I see so many times where people just bring the people I've worked with the most.
Yeah.
Because of trust, whereas Graham hadn't worked with either of them.
Right.
And, like, when you think about it in that sense, I'm like, wow, like, you've got to take your hat off to him. Like, what do you think that made Graham as a coach, better or worse?
Yeah, 100%, hey.
No? Yeah, sure, there was friction, a lot of ego, a lot of people with different ideas. But we found a way to work together. You know, Gilbert came on board as well. So there was sort of this group of five of us. We started leadership groups with the players, which we hadn't had in the past. So suddenly there was a shared responsibility for a legacy that we were given the pleasure of looking after, you know. And that was a real strength. Yes, everyone saw Graham out the front. Of course, that's the coach's role because most people want to talk about the game. But that's 80 minutes a week. There's, 6 days and 22 hours of other stuff as well.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how we rolled, and that's sort of where it all started.
How many? So you'd worked with Steve Hansen before, and had you worked with Gilbert Anoka with Crusaders? Because I think Smithy brought him in, didn't he?
Yeah, no, he was with Smithy. Had a little bit of contact with Gilbert because Gilbert probably started with the All Blacks when Smithy did. So and he actually survived. Mitch actually kept him on in a sort of small role as well. So he actually went from 2000 to 2023. And so I had a little bit of exposure, not a huge amount, but there was he'd left a lot of legacy, you know, with the way Smithy did things, and Robbie was very much of the same, you know, making around, you know, theming and building something bigger than the game for the team to be connected with and focused on. So and then Gilbert really came in as a mental skills specialist, really. Just we always felt that one of the things we decided early on was that the players found it easy to sweat. And so better you just sweated more, whereas we felt the gap, particularly around World Cups for us, had been things like freeze, you know. And that whole notion of flight and flight and fright and all that. You know, we needed to work on the other muscle, which they didn't use much, which was the mind. Gilbert was the best at that, and Gilbert got better people in as well to help him with it. People like Kerry Evans and Renzi Hannum and people like that, you know, that really helped us sort of explore that area and that period from probably post 07 through to, you know, 15, 16, we were, you know, literally unstoppable, you know, we're number one for 10 years. So,
yeah. How was that shift from 04 And I was thinking about it today, obviously, I would assume that your management team in 2023 had grown exponentially compared to what you may have traveled with in 2004,
yeah.
Which must, and I guess that all rests on you at the end in terms of that logistics. I'm sure everyone's doing their job, but.
Yeah, no, collective. Like, I think it's funny actually, when I was thinking about 07, we had like 12 or 13 people and we felt we had too many.
And yeah.
It wasn't that we had too, it wasn't the number that mattered, it was the way people went about their role. So some people wanted to do more because they were there actually, but we didn't need them to do more. You know, like, well, I need you to be the physio, not the physio, the doctor and the trainer, for example, you know?
Or yeah.
I need you to be the skills coach, not the backs coach and the forwards coach. And
yeah.
Last year at the World Cup, well, in the last couple, we've had close to 25 people, and I don't feel like we've got too many.
Yeah, okay.
It's so clear what success, how success is defined, what's needed, what resources are needed, and when, and who does them, and how they do them. And, you know, if you think, I love the analogy that a bit like the players on the field, they all have a jersey with a number, so does staff. Yeah. You know? And you tell a new player when he comes in, okay, you're the number 11, that's all we need you to do, because the guy's playing 13 inside you and the 15 at the back, he's got your back, and they'll be doing their role and they just expect you to do yours. And so the same applies to the staff, you know? Because, you know, and people feel like, and I find it interesting when I go into the corporate world, everyone's in a race to get on top of each other and get ahead. Actually, why not just look at yourself and think, where am I now? How can I be better? And I can't recall anyone I've worked with who's worked with me where there's no room at the top to keep improving.
Yeah.
And actually, if you keep improving you, then suddenly the things that you're aiming for start to happen to you, you know? Whereas if you stay in the middle or you live below the line and it's everyone else's fault and, you know, you make excuses and whatever else, you stay where you are. So that was an amazing sort of lesson to learn and understand.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. Like you mentioned below the line, I'd like you to expand on that a little bit. But I was thinking when you said Gilbert's name and right at the start of this chat, I said, you know, like, as I said, offline, I said I've heard you speak a couple of times at HPSNZ, but there seems to be this group who are working with the All Blacks but are happy to do it quietly, I guess, would be what I'd say. Like Gilbert Anoka, again, he's amazing, but he just goes about his business, does his job. There's no fanfare around it. Is that an intentional thing? Is that like, and it almost a little bit matches up with what you said about Graham Henry, as in getting people who are maybe better than him as coaches, and then that sort of humility. Is that a big part of it?
I don't think you try. Well, yeah. I guess as Kiwis, it is part of our DNA, you know? Like, we love being the little guy that punches above our weight, and then we just, when we achieve it, we're just like, oh, yeah, that's just normal, you know?
Yeah.
We're not like America. That's just not who we are. But I think what was so key in the All Blacks was that through this whole period, if I look at foundational stones, the we over me was so strong, you know? Like, it was just drummed into everybody, and it was called out by others if you weren't that way.
And that was everybody, management, players, everybody. Oh,
yeah, yeah. And yeah. And one of the things I'm most proud of in the team was that we treated everybody the same, you know? So, like, players, it can become it can become an environment for a player where you've got all these staff and they can become highly dependent on the staff, you know, because everything's there. Now, what happens on a Saturday is they get put out on the field and they have to be independent because the staff aren't involved. And so if they're dependent all week and then you ask them on Saturday to be independent, that ain't going to work, is it? So you've got to create that independence through the whole environment, and everything you do has to be about that. And so that was – we felt then, okay, we've got the players set up in that space. Now management, we've got to treat them the same. Like, they're working just as hard, harder. Some people will jump on the players might fly. Most of the time we all flew business class, but sometimes management had to jump down the back. And then they arrive and then you're saying to the physio, now you've got to treat for the next 8 hours and you've just got off 36 hours of flying. Like,
yeah.
Is that care? Is that building a great environment. And so that's what I was really proud of in the end, that we treated all the team. There was teams within the team, but we treated everybody the same, the culture, the way we lived, how we behaved, what the expectations was team-wide. You know, it wasn't just, well, we expect that from the players, but, you know, the players, you all have to be on time, but if management turns up late, that's fine. I'll give you an example. At the 2015 Rugby World Cup, we decided when we were jet-lagged, what we did for the first couple of days when we got to a country is we'd knock out a whole lot of commercial work because we could do that jet lag, but we couldn't do much stuff physically. So we couldn't really train. So it just made sense to, you know, compartmentalize it. So we went to London and we stayed right in the city. We had a welcome ceremony that we had to go to at London Tower, and we based ourselves there, did all this commercial work. And before World Cups, there's often stuff you've got to do for World Rugby courses. You've got to listen to people speak about anti-doping and all that stuff. So we had a guy from World Rugby come in to speak to us, and all the teams in the team room ready to go for this meeting, you know. And we have the system in the All Blacks, a buddy check. You know, everyone has a buddy, and it's up to you to make sure your buddy's in the right place at the right time, you know. So anyway, there was one missing, Sir Steve Hansen. and I was always like, you know, I got it drummed into me with Steve Chu, you know, the 10 o'clock meeting starts at 10 o'clock, you know. And we had a saying, All Blacks, if you're 5 minutes early, you are late, you know. So it went 10 o'clock and I was like, well, this gentleman's come from World Rugby, he's come from across town, I'm going to start this meeting, you know. And Steve's not here, and a couple of the coaches, Steve's not here, said, I don't care, it's 10 o'clock, we're starting. So we started the meeting, and Steve walked in late. And anyway, one of the players, Kevin Mialamu, stood up, said to me, excuse me, Darren, can we stop for a minute? I said, yeah, sure. And he then said, Steve, not good enough. 49 of us made it on time, and you haven't. That is not the only way. Sat down. That was the end of it. We can carry it on. Steve, to his great credit, acknowledged it later to the team, you know. Didn't make excuses. Just, yeah. But how powerful, you know. Like,
yeah.
That shared leadership, that Kevy cared. You know, he cared so much about everything and how it was. And I was so proud of the guy. You know, like, I first met Kevy in 2000 with New Zealand A, and he was this quiet, shy little boy from, you know, South Auckland. And then at his peak as a player and as a person, that he had the courage to, you know, to call out Steve, like, amazing, you know. So that, yeah, you get those types of things in the environment. It's yeah, it's impressive.
I'd love to know what was going through his head, or what do you think was like? Did he have an internal debate going, oh, should I call out Steve Hansen, or should I just not just that's how? Why only Kev? How many other players do you think could have done that?
Yeah, well, I think that leadership group of that period was a, you know, some of the best, didn't you? You know, Richie, yeah. Dan, Kevy, Conrad, Ma'anonu, a real mixture, and all of them were at the peak of their powers in 15.
Yeah,
and I think Kevy, I think they all had roles too, and so Kevy very much worked with Gilbert and I a lot on the off field side and the induction of new players and teaching and helping new players understand how it was to be in this team. You know, like, you don't join us, you join us, we don't join you. It was kind of the philosophy. And so, yeah. And while we didn't have an environment where we wanted to catch people out, we had an environment about catching people up, we were catching up with people. So it was more about how do we shape this environment so that people can be themselves. There's a framework. There's expectations, and I think the whole environment was shaped more on expectation than on rules. You know, like, I watch some of the other codes, and whenever there's issues, they just add more layers, you know, integrity units, more rules. And what happens with rules? People break them. But expectations that are held by your peers with each other is way more powerful. So with the players, we just had that, you know, defined way of acting, and they led it. I'll give you another great example. Ma'anonu knocked on my door one day, this was pre 2015, he sort of just made the leaders group, and him and Kevi were really probably the kaumatuas of the Māori and Pacifica boys. You know, they were really looked up to, and you know, in that culture, leadership is kind of defined by age and experience. And but not to say they were great men as well, which helped too.
Yeah, but yeah.
Mark came to my room and he goes, "Oh, can we go have a coffee?" I said, "Oh, okay." So we wandered down the road and said, "Oh, bro, like, you know, leadership meetings, I just." He said, "What do you notice?" I said, "Oh, you're pretty quiet. You know, you don't say much." He goes, "Oh, I'm so nervous. I said, "Oh," he goes, "Oh, like Richie, you know, like when Richie says something, it's like, who's ever going to say that? And I was like, wow, like that's, thank you for sharing that, you know, because here was someone who had things to share, but he couldn't. And if Richie had known that, he would want to have known that, you know.
Mm.
So I went and had a chat to Gilbert about it. I said, "Oh, what do you reckon we do about this?" You know, and so we sort of restructured how we ran our leaders' meetings. So we sent out the homework before the meeting, like all the questions that we wanted to work through. And then when they arrived, rather than all sitting down and just, you know, Gilbert used to facilitate the meetings, and rather than picking someone out to share, we put them in groups of two, you know, and they shared with each other. And then we brought the twos and made them fours. And we got one of the four to speak, you know. And so we went from like that in terms of bandwidth of information from the group to that, you know.
Yeah.
And what it grew the trust enormously between that group, you know, because Richie was he was so into being the best he could and knew that he needed everyone else with him, you know. He couldn't do it on his own. It was really defining, you know. And, you know, I just love Ma'a for doing, you know, having the courage to actually have a crack at it. And then it was so good. It was one of the best things. I actually, at the same time, I think there might have been Kerry Evans had done a bit of work with us, and he'd talked about this experiment done in Germany the turn of the century by a German guy called Ringelmann. And so what Ringelmann did is he looked at he measured the force exerted on a rope in a tug of war. And what he did is he added different numbers of people to the rope and measured the effort each person put in. And what he found is that the more people he added to the rope, the less effort every person put in. And he coined it social loafing.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, so that in a team situation, often you have social loafing. So for us, that was apparent because as soon as Richie spoke, everyone else would either say the same thing or would social loaf. So that kind of became our cue, you know, like we get into meetings and we got past the twos and the fours to speak to the point where they'd all speak. But if you had the odd day where someone didn't quite have the energy, you go, social loafing, you know?
Yeah.
It kind of became the cue for it. It's like, okay, I've got to, you know, think here and contribute and make known what I need to do as a leader. So.
Yeah, the leadership group I find really interesting, particularly, as you say, around that era. And if we just isolate two, probably Ma'a and Conrad Smith, and I've seen a few All Blacks YouTube things of those two having a coffee, and they seem like they get on great. And they seem so different in terms of their outlook. And so I guess that's obviously critical for a leadership group, whether it's business or sport, to have that diversity. But is there a point of still getting the diversity but with the right people, so it's not just diversity for diversity's sake? And how do you manage that in that All Black environment?
Yeah, 100%, I think. What we learned very early on, it's interesting now sort of trying to work outside of sport and a little bit in business, but understanding what are the building blocks of leadership. And the world's changing in that space. You know, we used to lead, Gilbert shared a statement with us once, in leadership, everything has changed, but nothing has changed. And that, you know, to be successful requires great leadership, but how you do it has changed immeasurably. You know, like the great leaders of the past, probably also they were reasonably direct and you do it my way and jump on board, or I'm the most charismatic person here, follow me. But when I leave, then the organisation will fall apart because I'm not here. Mm. And learned those lessons early. So we decided that unless we had an environment where trust and vulnerability were really high, we wouldn't be successful. And so to your point, yeah, the person mattered more than the diversity. We were lucky in that we had a diverse group anyway, so no matter – where we pulled from, we were going to end up with a diverse group because most of the time we had at least 50 50% off and more Māori Pacifica in the group anyway. And and what we also did around that in terms of choice is people say, well, how did you choose your leaders? Well, in the end, was actually asking, was defining what you needed from your leaders. And in the simplest essence, because I talked a little earlier about, you know, that we needed independent athletes who, you know, could make great decisions under pressure. That's what we have to do every time we walk out onto the playing field. Be independent, be capable of making really good decisions constantly and under pressure. And so question for the other players about who they want to lead them was, who do you turn to under pressure? Who in this team would you turn to? Didn't need to ask any more. Like, it's that simple, because there's trust. I trust him. That's the foundation. You know, like, if you can't trust someone, you're never going to be able to have a conversation that you believe. Like, if you trust them, you can have an open conversation. You can debate issues. I was just reading some stuff Smithy said the other day. We had this great saying in the All Blacks that you could disagree, but you had to commit.
Yeah.
And that was the foundation of all that. We had those great discussions, but we'd always commit, and there'd always be accountability, and it was always for the sake of the team. And that sort of formed the framework. That's always kind of been the way it's through the period that I had there.
Yeah. And when you were talking about Ma'a, I was thinking, and how you described him, and I know that I spent a bit of time with Smithy, and he's a massive fan of Ma'a. Was he a reluctant leader? And did you have many reluctant leaders? And did you just say, hard luck, mate, you are a leader, it is what it is, and you're just going to have to deal with it? Or was it, okay, you don't have to be?
No, we didn't let people off. That was more sometimes we chose the wrong people. You know, Jerry Collins, RIP. We made him All Black captain. and sometimes people are soldiers and they're not generals, you know. And yes, Jerry could lead by his example on the field, but some of the behaviours off the field didn't say to us that you're a leader, you know. Yet Jerry as a soldier was awesome, you know. Because of some of the things that happened off field, the boys didn't know if they could totally trust him, you know.
And yeah.
That's, you can't have that. Yet, you know, Jerry, I think outside of his moments on the field, which were pretty impactful for Jerry, but one of the greatest things he ever did, he captained us in Argentina, and we had to go to an aftermatch, and he did the – his whole speech as a captain was done in Spanish. Perfect. It was unbelievable. Like, just, you know, like, people have these talents. But, yeah, there was a lot. I guess I think of people like Mills, Molaina, Rodney Soyalo, Ma'a Kevi for a start. You know, they just had to – we just had to build a space that they felt happy in, and a space that they could be themselves. Was on us really as a group. And I say, you know, the power of many in terms of that leadership group within management was the making of it, you know, because we knew we had to allow them to lead. We knew that the captain couldn't do it all on his own. The whole point of the leadership group was to have at least five or six leaders on the field all the time. And that's why we had a bigger group than five or six, because, you know, the game was changing. People weren't playing 80 minutes anymore. And that was really, you know, where it all sort of stemmed from and where it grew to.
Like Gilbert said about the leadership changes but doesn't change concept, how different was it? Could your 2004 model of leadership, would that have worked in 2023? Not to say better or worse, but would that same style, or, and I guess if not, then how did it evolve over those 20-odd years?
Yeah, so if you remember when we started in 04, we had a, I don't know, usually we would hang over lightly, but we had a lot of Mitch's crew still, and a lot of players, Mertens, Marshall, Case Muse, people that were coming to the end. And then we had a lot, like we had Richie, Dan, Conrad, Tony Woodcock, who just sort of started their careers. And we had a pretty average Tri-Nations, I think it was then. I think we got pumped by South Africa in Joburg, actually the day that Nelson Mandela came to watch, which you know you're on the back foot when Mandela turns up. and we came home. We had a terrible post-match in Johannesburg, which I think has been talked about at times, just players out of control with booze and terrible flights home. And Smithy came down the flight, said off. He'd given up coaching and Northampton to come back, and he's like, oh, if this is what I've come back to, I don't want to borrow this, you know. Mm. And we actually also had Sir Brian Lahore with us at that stage as a selector. So I think we all met in Wellington and decided we've got to turn this around, you know. We've got to redefine how we are and who we are. And interestingly, also the players didn't love the All Blacks as much as they loved their super clubs. They enjoyed it more. So that was, you know, that's pretty hard to face as a management group too. So we started this leadership group. The foundation was about we need the leadership group to be the best players on the field, and we need them to understand what it looks like, feels like, sounds like. And we took quite a theoretical approach probably initially. One of Gilbert's best mates was a guy, Ian Colpin, who was one of the best educationists in the country, worked at UC in Christchurch in the in that particular area. And while it was good, the to your question around what did that in 04 worked in 23, no, because we took this real sort of theoretical approach, which was not transferable to the game. And it actually took us to go through the hurt of 07 to lose that quarterfinal in Cardiff to understand that, yes, we've identified an area of our environment alongside culture. Leadership plus culture generally gives performance if you've got those two well sorted. But we didn't, while we put the emphasis on it, we hadn't put it on the right things. So we then, you know, one of my overwhelming memories of that 07 game was sitting on the sideline watching us just attack the French line. I think we had 25 minutes in the French 22 in the second half, but couldn't score. And yeah. I sit on the bench because I do the subs and stuff. And I just remember Richie looking across at the bench like I don't know what to do. And yeah. In that moment, I was not like angry with Richie, or I was thinking, we've let you down, mate, you know, like we haven't given you the tools or the rest of the team the tools to deal with it. And, you know, sure, Wayne Barnes and all of that, but in the end, you know, you've got to look inside yourselves and figure it out. So that kind of became the climate for change. And we got a pretty high-powered group in, I think, around 08 of people from that space to talk to us about it and who'd worked in sports and what they'd done. And we just sort of kept building it. Kerry Evans sort of got involved a bit around that time. He bought a model of understanding about how the brain works under pressure that was so simple, so incredibly simple, and it just completely resonated. And we had another guy who was very influential called Don Tricker, who was working at New Zealand Rugby as a high-performance manager. And Don's a wise man, great with process and the coaching pedagogy. And between those two, you know, Don bought this beautiful model of what are the pillars of high performance, what in terms of getting the athlete right, what do they need, you know. And once we could demonstrate that to the players, they could see it was beyond just sweating, that we need to work that muscle and that muscle, and we've got to get things working good at home for you as well. And and then Kerry's work around the brain, it just suddenly we had this everything that really related to the game. And just kept growing it. And you know, as Gilbert always used to say to us, you know, I'm not sure which. It's not like a linear progression. It's, you know, on a road that's got many tangents, and we kept chasing little pieces and taking the good out of those. And because I guess, you know, in sport, you know, small margins, and you're looking for those one percenters all the time. And you know the direction, you have the vision, but how you do that changes, even if it's for the same sort of outcome, you know, to get these guys better mentally prepared. We might try that. And again, within a group, you've got every year different group. You've got some who are experts, some who are novices. Some years the dial for leadership needs to be empowerment for the players. Other years, you got a newer leadership. We'll just dial that back. We'll give management a bit more empowerment, and then we'll bring the leaders in. So it was always, you've got those dynamics that you're constantly trying to assess and set the environment up for success.
Yeah. A couple of things there I really want to dig into with you. And just before that, Don Tricker occasionally speaks at HPSNZ things, and I met him last time he was over. Literally met him as in, hi, I'm Jay. He said, hi, I'm Don. And then the next morning I was in the elevator, and he goes, morning, Jay, how are you? And I just thought, holy shit, how did he do that? Because there's thousands of us at this conference, right? Like, I'm just a punter like everyone else. He's one of the speakers, so of course I remember him. But anyway, I thought that was fascinating. Who drove in your group? Like, you know, Gilbert said it's not linear, and there's that, I can't remember who says it in the complexity stuff, where you kind of go probe, sense, respond, as in I'm going to probe this, see what happens, respond. How do you know what's working over and above just winning? Because the All Blacks, as prior to that, you know, they won with maybe a toxic culture leading up around, you know, that pre-04 sort of stuff. So just because you're winning may not always be the best indicator that everything's on track. And how do you stop yourself, I guess what I'm asking is, how do you stop yourself going down rabbit holes and being seduced by, oh, we won that, so this must be working? Who's in charge of that? Was that your role?
Oh, I guess, again, I don't like, because it was always about team.
You know? Yeah.
Like, and, yes, let's say if you boil mine down to two areas, operations and the business were probably my key focuses, you know. And that areas that required a lot of planning, because there's a whole lot of tasks that have to happen there, you know. And a lot of those, you just want them to happen seamlessly and no one even notices, you know. They only notice when the system breaks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I always give the analogy, you know, like if everything's going really well and the bus is 5 minutes late, it's not a problem for the team. Because
yeah.
the culture deals with it, and they don't blame me. They understand that you've got 2,000 things right out of 2,001, and you've just got one wrong, you know. And they get that because they appreciate that, because they see that, and we involve them in that, you know. Like, you don't let the kit man pick up all the gear after training. Like, the team brings it in to the kit man's shed, you know. Yeah. Like that's it's like the sweeping the sheds analogy, you know. That's what the All Blacks are about. And so I think it was always about the we, you know, like always robust. Gilbert was great at chasing that with, like, him and Kerry, just two bright minds, you know, and that constantly, that was a space that we really, like, I just forget the coaches because I just know they just, like, Smithy just wants to talk code all day. Steve enjoys nothing better over a beer doing that. Smithy would do it over a computer. Fozzie the same. All the coaches I met, they love code. That's why they coach, you know.
Yeah.
And so you always knew that they were chasing that. And I just had so much faith in them, you know, that they would. And then I thought, oh, where can I help? How can I help? I've got to get my house in order because it's a big house. It's growing. There's a whole lot of things that can distract us, take us away. And then yeah, Gilbert really honed in on that mental skills area and the environment. And I think what we did is we shared. So Gilbert would bring a new idea. We'd share it as a group. We'd toss it around. Coaches, particularly in Steve's time, he'd look really closely about how that could link with the actual playing performance and how he could inspire, motivate, and bring people with him. So I think one of the things we also learned is that if you search for silver, you know, don't search for silver bullets. Try and have a bulletproof plan. So I think we always had a are you familiar with Jim Collins, the good to great? Yeah, so Jim Collins talked about the hedgehog, you know, the fable of the hedgehog and the fox. You know, the fox tries to attack from this angle, but the hedgehog just goes in the ball and the fox can't get him. It's like, just remember what your core is. And I think we always had a core, you know, like it was very much a core around how we want to be, how we want to be seen, how we play the game. And then we'd play around the edges, you know, like we'd bump. And we knew we had to keep bumping because those were the one percenters. And so I think philosophically, there was a risk of a lot of that, because as you do well, you demand attention. People want more of you. A little funny story. We had a lady come to us who was a peripheral vision specialist, and she'd worked with her story was that she'd worked with the Springboks, and that she'd taught Brian Habana to, you know, get intercepts, she was a scientist, gosh, you could go down a rabbit hole there, you know. But we came back to Don's principles around, you know, if it's not technical, if it's not tactical, if it's not nutritional, physical, not mental, or not holistic around the player's development, let's forget it, you know. If it doesn't fit with independence, decision-making under pressure, let's not, you know. Like if you keep having those principles to the fore, you're always coming back to those, like hedgehog, it made that sort of decision-making quite easy.
Yeah. And so you talked about Smithy saying disagree and commit in that in those roles. I assume the rugby decisions come back to the head coach as the final say, but do the other decisions, you say that it's a team approach and clearly understand that, but at some point there's got to be someone that draws the line in the sand.
Yeah.
How hard is that?
I think wasn't so Perrin and Graham's time, but certainly in Steve's time where the whole commercial side ramped up, suddenly we're facing all these challenges we hadn't had before. We were asked more and more, people wanted in a little bit more insight in how we were and then how we were presented, by partners and so forth. So, I was charged with bringing a lot of that to the group to share, and so there's a lot of debate about that.
Yeah.
But in Steve's time, we had a group of four of us, myself, Fozzie, Steve and Gilbert, and we named ourselves a sweet spot. So we were the intersection of three circles. So I led operations, Gilbert led player wellbeing, and Fozzie led coaching, and then Steve was the umbrella. And then The intersecting circle was a sweet spot, and that's what we called ourselves. And we had a rule in the sweet spot that was voting was by democracy. So, I remember once a campaign by Adidas about blackness and the parts of it Steve didn't like, but he got outvoted 3-1 and went ahead, So, but you're right, the rugby was like, in the end, the rugby decisions, the coaches, they had those decisions, they figured that out. And even in our leaders group, the technical weren't really, it was much more about environment, mindset, behaviors, how we're going to be rather than how we're going to play. And when we dipped into how we're going to play, we actually keep giving ourselves an upcoat. Oh, no, that's coaches. We've got to find another way to do that conversation here because that's insular. This is wider. It needs to keep being wider because we've got to keep a stethoscope across the environment and the health of our environment. That's what our role is,
Yeah. How, when you're away, you personally, with a World Cup campaign, you must just be on the whole time in terms of, because you have so many moving parts to the role. And I'm sure all the players are and so are the coaches, but more. Yeah. What do you do for your well? And well-being is a thing at the moment, but what do you do for your well-being? Because you must be, you're not just that 80 minutes, right? You are literally 24/7.
I often say to people, the test match for me was my fun day. I would just sit there and on the sideline and be part of it. And yes, I had to do the subs and get that right. And there's been a few stories about me mucking that up, but that was all good. And then, but literally, then on Sunday when everyone's resting, that was like test match for us because we got to move, And we're going to a new, because we were home on the road. We didn't have a base, We were at a different venue every week. And the expectation was that venue had everything we needed at the highest level possible. And so, you're tired, you're emotionally probably at a lower point of the week because you're starting again, and yet you've still got to arrive at this new hotel and have a great dinner served in the gym, be with all the best facilities in the field, be perfect. And but I think in the end, the pressure was on us. I never worried about the external pressure. It was uncontrollable, so I just dismissed it. But internally, it was just building faith in people, because I knew operations was actually just a system, It was just and if we had a great system and then I had four or five people managing that system, as long as they worked within the system, we had so much knowledge that if everything was ticked in the system, then it's all good, I didn't have to worry about it because high trust, always a bit like the coaches, I wanted people pushing me. So I want them to be better, So I had to give them string. And that was just the way it became. Downtime, essential. I love cycling, so I often travel with my bike. So got to see a lot of the world. Take that with me. And I think you have your own habits, routines on the road, and you just get into those and when you've got breaks and you take them. The cadence was high, but it was never – the longer you went, the easier it became, because there wasn't much you hadn't seen. I don't mean that in a way that I was ever complacent because things would always pop up, but you were just used to dealing with those sorts of things. And we had a piece of research that we presented by a guy from HBCNZ who did a big study on Olympic athletes' success. And one of his conclusions was you can never outperform your preparation. And so, like in my space, I knew we could probably, if we got 90% of it ready to go on arrival, we were in great shape. You know, that was a gold medal because
Inevitably
there was going to be 10% that would pop up. And once I got people away from thinking they've got to be perfect to actually, you know, we just got to get to that point, then we as people will deal with it. It takes away the stress of it, you know. And, you know, if you have some great systems, great structures, great skill sets, yeah. And we've always talked about performance being a mixture of mindset, skill set, and structure. And if there's an issue, it's one of those things that you got to fix. So I just knew I had to have the structure right, you know, and I needed to upskill my people to be real experts in the area. And it was kind of left with me to drive the mindset for them to keep going and not be people pleasers, but be enablers, you know, enable people to get the information they needed rather than just saying yes, yes, yes all the time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Steve would ring me up. Oh, you got so-and-so's phone number? I'm like, Steve, turn your phone off, push that app, see the search thing, scroll there, write the person's name. Oh, bingo, there it is, you know. I'm not your secretary. So it was about us teaching them too, you know. And, again, self-reliant. How can you ask a player to be self-reliant? You can't find his phone number.
So – that's interesting because there's that saying around the All Blacks talk about the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. Yeah. And is that, and you mentioned before 25 support staff or management staff. So let's say, I'm assuming there's not a massive hierarchy there, but let's say the newest, the youngest person into that crew.
Yeah.
Do you expect them to call you out if you do something out of line? And I'm assuming you're going to say yes to that. And then the next bit is, do they call you out? Do the juniors call out the seniors, I guess?
Yeah. I think, you know, normal human behavior would say no.
Yeah.
Because people come in with their eyes wide open and with a certain expectation, don't they? I think – particularly if I look at the player side, we really needed that because doesn't matter what your experience is in terms of getting the game right, you know, because everyone needs to commentate the game. So, and it doesn't matter if you're, if you're like Lester Fainga-Nuku coming in for the Irish game, he's got to be able to articulate himself to Rico, you know, for what he's seeing. And so, You've got to create space for that to happen. And I think, I look at we had a few doctors over the years, and you think that role takes a lot of courage because often you've got to, you know, you can be, you know, most players don't run on the field at 100%. So where's the line that you're prepared to call around their personal safety? You know, for them, that's an ethical question because they've trained in that space. And, you know, I'm proud of the people we had in those roles that they were the right person to do that, you know. Then I was equally proud of a coach that would accept that and say, well, yeah, on my watch, I care and I'm not going to put the player at risk. So I think generally, yes, you know, like I think for most people it would take a little bit of time to get to that exact point. But there was often enough people around that someone would, you know, like we're not living in isolation on the road.
Yeah.
And there's certainly some better than others, you know, like Dane Coles, champion. Like he just, you know, Coles, you didn't need anything to follow, you know. If I share another example, one that I really loved that I got a lot of pleasure from was Artie. So one of the things I loved about Artie was that which was a huge problem for me at the same time, was Artie created Artie Savia Clothing. And prior to him starting Artie as Savia Clothing, I think we'd talked or Adidas had talked to me about potentially they couldn't get Artie to sign with them as an individual athlete. And because Artie was new age, you know, like signing with one of the big guys was kind of not Artie's style, you know?
Yeah.
But, one of Adidas's brands is Originals, which is more street and fashion oriented, and having already done something with Ma'a with them before around a boot design, and using Ma'a's presence and image to, you know, like, that was a big breakthrough moment for Ma'a, that he was actually, if I act and behave well, these are the opportunities that come my way, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, Artie sort of had this opportunity with the Originals, and it never happened. So, and he pushed go on his own thing, and then a lot of the stuff he came out with was very similar to some of the ideas that we'd been sharing with Adidas on. So suddenly there was just like this tension, you know, like commercial tension. And Artie was pushing the limits, and I was trying to broker both sides. And because what I loved was that a player was trying to do something for his family. It was outside of the game, was entrepreneurial. And so Brian Lahore had coined the, you know, better people make better All Blacks. And I believe that, you know, like I just have this insatiable faith that people can get better. Like, I believe in people, you know. And I was like, yeah, I'm for this, but how do I've got the, you know, I got the CEO of Adidas Global, you know, noticing this. So, you know, we had lots of conversations about it. We found a way for it to cooperate together. And then it was rolling. It was going nicely. Still a little bit of tension, but nowhere near the tension it was. Then as the sort of commercial space grew, I had to more and more coach the players about how and what and why. And I remember Artie, like the last probably 3-4 years when I'd spoken, he would then get up and speak in support of me around, hey, boys, you know, like, you know, I've got my own clothing thing, but look at me now. Like, do you see any Artie Sevier clothing on me? No, this is All Black time. We're Adidas. And just, it was so good because we had a group of younger men this generation who just like to be not like the normal, you know?
Yeah.
And so how do you be yourself but still fit into this corporate machine that you're part of as the All Blacks? And again, it was just, without us being overly prescriptive, we had to find a way where we could accommodate both. And my role was to ensure that the people that were funding it were happy too, you know. And I just always took the philosophy, it's got to be a win-win, you know. How do you win, how do we win? And generally, it, you know, it worked pretty well. We had the odd hiccup, but mostly it was just great. I just loved that the players owned the space of how we were, you know. And I guess increasingly, less, I almost became invisible as a leader because I didn't need to. You know, I could lead in different ways. You know, my leadership was coaching players to be better leaders in front of the team because I knew the peer-to-peer carried more significance than me, you know. And then certainly in leadership meetings with the players, that was my time to shine because I saw the world differently from the coaches, and I could challenge them, challenge the coaches, challenge the players, just bring a different perspective, you know, because I wasn't a code guy, you know. So, yeah.
How have the players changed in that time? I'm thinking back to, you said maybe the drinking culture early in 2004, and if I think back to the, you know, I guess you and I growing up, this All Black stories around the night after the test sort of stuff would be massive. And nowadays with professionalism, not to say that they don't celebrate and have a good time, but is it harder now, do you think, for the players with the amount of they don't necessarily have that, not to say that the drinking is the way. I guess what I'm saying maybe is the level of intensity that goes into expectations around the work they do and the clutter maybe in their head. Is that an issue or not?
I think the whole notion of decompression is the hardest thing to get your head around, you know. Don't think ever found the answer. We went to some of the finest institutions in the world, and alcohol is still involved in decompression for most people.
Yeah.
In the biggest and, you know, most well-known military units, you know. So yeah. It's just finding the right way. And I said to you, probably we helped them understand what it meant to be a professional athlete properly. We asked, we took a global approach to it. So rather than letting it just happen organically, we would plan it and say, okay, we've got a 12-week campaign, and we do this with our leaders. And say, righto, where are we going to need a break, boys? Okay, let's plan that for there. How do we want that to roll? Get them involved in it. Get them to run it, you know? And because in educating them around all the science about themselves, they actually learn, oh gosh, yeah, now if I if I have a big night, that puts me 2 days behind the guy that I'm trying to compete with.
Mm.
He hasn't been drinking because he didn't play this week. And he's going to get my jersey.
Yeah.
So we developed this beautiful thing called co-opetition, you know, so cooperative competition. So we'll help each other get better. And so there's a sense I don't want to let him down, so I'm not going to let the team down. And I think that was as simple as that, really. We had, especially after matches, we would set a rule. Hence why Mark Tillier got dropped for the quarterfinal of the World Cup.
I wanted to talk about that. So
we played our last pool match on Thursday in France, and the quarterfinal was the following Saturday. So we had a 10-day turnaround. So really wanted to have the first 2 days, probably make it a 7-day prep, not a 10-day, because just we're worried about taking them mentally too far, which is what we'd learnt in 19, where I think we lost a match due to a tornado or what was it, a typhoon in Japan, and we missed the match, had 10 days, played Ireland, absolutely smashed them in the quarter and then lost to England. Mm. We'd overcooked ourselves emotionally and didn't have anything for the next week. So not even thinking about next week when you're playing Ireland at the 23 World Cup, but we felt they needed a bit of a break, and we'd had a break earlier in the tournament, which disappointed me a little bit about how much of a break, sort of how hard they went with it, you know, like no damage done or anything, but I was a little surprised, you know, that they really felt they needed that much. And I always look at ourselves first and go, have we made the environment too tough here, you know, that they need that, or how can we tweak it? But we just got some things probably wrong within that. But no damage done. But again, sometimes through having those experiences, it's a really nice little, little X sharpener, you know, just a little bit of credit to use. So the next time we came, I remember sitting in the meeting before the quarterfinal, sort of what we were thinking about it. And they said to me, well, Shandy, what do you think? You know, what intensity for this little? I said, well, boys, I think, you know, the last one we had in Toulouse, I would have probably put it like an 8-9 out of 10. But I think this one probably needs to be more around a 4-5, you know, like we need to find a way to pull it back a little bit, you guys to feel like we've given you a little bit of license and that you can then really hoe into this next week, because it's everything, you know, it's win or go home. And so we actually had a curfew that night, you know, and Mark missed it. So had a leaders meeting the next day, and Ian sort of positioned it that he wanted the players to decide. He let each of us, we all spoke in terms of how we felt about it. We actually walked out of the room and let them decide.
Wow. All of the players or the leadership group?
Players, leadership group, yeah.
Yeah.
And in the end, who we are and how we are was so ingrained that there was only one decision they could make, you know.
Mm.
As much as it hurt them and that this guy was tearing the world apart on the field and they were going to leave him out, but it was absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think every player I've seen who's had that what I call light bulb moment, it generally serves them well, you know.
Mm.
And he certainly played well for the rest of the tournament, so.
Yeah. whose job was it to tell them?
The players told them.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
That must have been tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he knew anyway, you know, like.
Yeah.
That's just how it rolls. And there's been other occasions we've had to do that as well. So.
Yeah. Are there I guess the question around that is, what happens to him that week? That must be hard to – does he just front up? Well, not necessarily that him, but someone in that situation. Do they just front up and do the work and get on, or is there support wrapped around them?
I know, yeah, there's support. Yeah, there's no doubt. And, you know, one of the beautiful things, again, I want to credit Artie here, is as the diversity of the group shifted and we became an even bigger group of, you know, Pacifica players, and Ian created a really safe place, you know, for the boys. In fact, for the first 2 years, we probably made it too comfortable for them, you know, because we were so conscious of it, and actually took it. I think it actually took a bit away from our performance, and because we created that, but we didn't demand the accountability on the other side. And once we got that balance right, then our performance shifted. But yeah, for example, in the last 3-4 years, the Carver sort of community became really big in the team, and she became a really was more regular than just after the game on a Sunday. There was a couple of hits a week, and it just became it was like the village, you know. You could just go to the village, sit there. There was music, there was dancing, there was laughter. If someone was struggling, they'd talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like therapy 101 in Artie's room, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was beautiful, you know. And as Artie said to me, you know, you white guys can come too, you know. But that was it's funny when I reflect now on some of the other sports and, you know, people talking about this, like, that's never been an issue for us. Like, I think there's always been the care, you know.
And
there's hard decisions and teams, and you don't always get to play. Again, I just share by way of about that is that we had five All Blacks spend most of last year with us as legends of the era that the group that we had looked up to, so younger legends. But one of them was Liam Messam, and people go, Liam Messam? And why did you choose him? I said, well, Liam Messam went to the 2015 Rugby World Cup. He was due to play one of the pool matches, pulled his calf, didn't play. So actually had no minutes at the World Cup.
Wow.
Got voted team man of the team, you know.
Yeah.
And ultimate sacrifice, hey, you know. And so when people sort of see that, and like having Liam around and pairing him with people that were going through that, like, was just so, it was gold, you know. And each of those legends had a different story around. Well, Kevin Mialamu, another one, you know, like, went to the 2015 World Cup, never started a game in the height of his career, but was the best number 16 in the world, you know. Dan Carter, obviously, you know, put me on the biggest lights and I'll give you the best performance, you know. I'll be crap in the pool phase, but give me the quarterfinal when it matters. You know, Conrad, low on talent, high on everything else, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't mean that disrespect, because he is a talented rugby player, but, yeah, you know, not as natural as some of the other players, not as physically gifted, but became so important to us for a whole lot of other reasons. So.
Yeah. How hard was 2022 for your group leading into that World Cup? And I guess, when did the legends start? Did you have the legends around then, or was that more just for 2023?
Yeah, that was more for 23, yeah. 21, 22 were hard. We didn't get the results. We were sort of at that sort of 65 to 70% win ratio. We were super 1 week, rubbish the next. I think there was a long tail to COVID in terms of impact, you know, and how people were. There was all the noise, constant noise around the team about coach and whether he should be there. And
yeah,
it's hard to ignore. Ian was just, I thought, very stately, very very composed, you know, through it all. Led incredibly well for considering what I thought was being dished out to him. And it did create a disconnect between the mothership and the team. And it was very hard to for a group of us who had spent so long in the era with Jock Hobbs and Mike Eagle as chairs and Steve Chu for a long time. It was such a departure from that. And we always felt that, you know, if the back office is humming, the front office hums too, you know.
It was
hard to live through that. And personally, hardest period for me, because I was on the executive of the main organisation, so felt extremely compromised. Trying to bat for our guys, not really feeling the love that I used to feel. And so much going on, you know, like Silver Lake, all these things outside that were pulling on our players' time, becoming distractions. Hell challenging. The coaching change that took a while to, you know, when Plums and Brad Moore left, you know, that took a while to cement, and getting Joe on board. So yeah, in the end, you know, you go through those and you look back and go, wow, what a fantastic campaign we ended up delivering, you know. Point and moved in so many areas, you know, like to see even in the highest level of high performance how quickly you can move when you get it all right, you know.
Yeah.
As what's Jim Collins saying, right people in the right seats on the right bus going in the right direction. and that's why it came together, and I was, you know, didn't quite get there, but gosh, I don't think anyone expected us to even get that close, you know.
So, no, and then, you know, like at the start of 2023, was it South Africa that you played first at, I was going to say Mount Smart. Was that 2023? The first game of the year, came out firing, and it was like, holy shit, what's happened here? And this is it, you know, are we crossing our fingers? And then right through, as you say, the year. Did you guys know internally that you were trending in the right direction? And, like, because there must have been doubt. Surely there must have been doubt.
You know, I think when we went to the World Cup, remember we played Africa in London, got smoked.
Yeah.
And then we played France first game and didn't, you know, quite pull that off. So we kind of stopped there and reframed and thought, oh, how are we going to get the best out of these next three matches, you know, Portugal, Namibia and Italy. And we had a week in Bordeaux, which was really important to us without a game. And whatever the coaches came up with worked there because it was a pretty combative week at training. Some things really started to cement in the game, particularly defence and understanding of that. And the level of competition for places just went through the roof that week. Like, it was a niggly week. Very intentional training, high intensity. And I think that Italy performance was a real, you know, we gave us Italy a lot of credit before that match. The stats said they were the fastest team with ruck ball in the world. So we said, well, we're going to play faster than them. And we did, and then they've blown away how fast we were, and that when they realised they couldn't keep up, that was it, you know, their heads went down and we smoked them. And I think that just built that belief and belief more in the structures and the way we were trying to do things. And there was a lot of micro skill work that, you know, you'd know with golf, but it's, you got to do a lot of it to for it to become instinctive rather than thought about. And this is some of the work Joe Schmidt was doing around the breakdown and that sort of thing to allow us to get that ball. What Jace had worked really hard on with the forwards around, you know, line out D and stopping rolling balls, and the work Fiki had done to get our scrum back up to being, you know, a weapon. Foz's vision for the first couple of phases and attack, you know, and so and him, his real ability to work so well with Joe Schmidt around space and, you know, how can we look at the game differently from a space perspective, you know. So that it just all came together, and the rest of us just jumped on board the wagon and made sure our stuff in order. And, you know, World Cups are different. You're moving a lot. It was pretty averagely organised tournament. So there was lots of things that didn't meet expectation. And so, like, my group were under a bit of pressure, you know, like often the training pitches weren't at the level we needed to, but you couldn't do anything about it. You just had to grim and bear it and try and, you know, World Cups are very prescriptive, you know. You can only go here and here. You can't just go and do your own thing. And everyone has to be equal. And you know, probably more work into that tournament than ever, but to get what we needed. But we still got surprised, you know. And I'm not surprised because that's France, you know. But it did create, you know, pressure every day to try and get things as best we could. But I guess through all that sort of helped us too, you know, because if we felt someone else was getting a better deal, that sort of drove us more, you know. I bet the French wouldn't be training on a pitch like this, you know.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Well, let's get into it, boys. You know?
Let's suck in.
So, yeah, that was all good.
And then how hard was that final to take? I mean, I was watching that in Melbourne and, gutting because it doesn't feel like it was rugby.
It's a really hard. I find it really hard to sort of say how I feel. There was massive pride
in
the fact that we'd made the dance floor. How we coped with the adversity of the match, unreal. Like, how we did it for so long with 14, just beyond me. You know, that's insane about the group. Probably created enough to win it. You know, my big lesson from 07 was you can look at the technicalities of the game around officiating that were wrong, but don't help you, you know.
No.
And again, those are out, you know, you can put those on the out of control side, and you've just got to, the controllables we had, we did enough to win. And sometimes in sport, like I've sat on the other side of those many times. I'm a pragmatist, and I was just, you know, I was just pleased to be there, really, you know. And, I love the uppies. Like, I love their grit, their, you know, like, you understand their history, you know why they're like that, you know.
Yeah.
What they went through as a, both in terms of the white people and the African people, you know, both of them faced massive challenges. That's why they've got that degree of resilience and fight, you know. But yeah, like, I'm a purist too. I love the game, to be played for the game. I felt, always felt they played to the letter of the law.
Yeah.
Rassie's a very clever coach. I'll leave it at that. And yeah. So that's a little bit hard, but yeah.
What about Sam? How hard was that for Sam to, you know, I mean, he cops it a little bit anyway, and I often think, you know, a guy can't get picked that often by that many different coaches.
Yeah.
Like, you can't bullshit for that long. He must be good. No, he must be respected. No,
yeah. Yeah, you're so spot on with that. He, I sort of felt his career has always been one step forward, two back, you know?
Yeah.
There's been so many things that have, you know, where he's just made all this progress and suddenly he's standing on the top of the dais and then, poof, he's like off it, you know, because of something. And, huge. You could see when Sam first came in, even when Richie was around, there was something about the kid, you know, like he knew who he was and he wasn't afraid to articulate. You know, he was the opposite of Ma. You didn't have to ask Sam not to talk at leaders' meetings, even when he was 21. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, but good, you know, because he backed it up on the field. You know, like, I think probably the quarterfinal was probably one of his greatest ever performances, you know, against all odds, and everyone had written him off and was calling for Dalton. And he was incredible, you know, like, and I think the boys voted him player of the match, you know.
Yeah.
Generally. So that means for me probably more to him, I think, than anything. But, yeah, like, he's sitting right here beside me, you know, with the yellow. I think Gilbert might have come down, and as Gilbert came, he looked at me and I already knew the decision. It's one of those times you can say nothing, eh? You just put your arm around him and try and stay in the moment for the team's sake, you know.
Yeah.
That's what he did. He was up on the sideline at the end too, so.
Yeah, poor bugger. So what's next for you, mate, now that you're not with the All Blacks? That must be – you must have a shit ton of free time that you're not used to.
Yeah.
But what's next career-wise?
I felt I was a bit institutionalised, actually. I've sort of taken a step back for a few months. I kind of might sound a bit stupid, but I've tried to sort of redefine who I am now. What am I about? What can I offer? Where can I add the most value? I very much thought I'd want to go into another job, but talked to a few people and they said, no, don't even think about it. Go on your own. You've got so much opportunity. Found some great people to help me with that. So I've built a wee business, which I'm hoping will grow into involving some other people, like-minded people with me in the high-performance space. I think the general principles all around sort of how teams within teams can help teams be great. You know, you need everyone around the team to be great for the team to be great. That whole notion of we, you know, we over me. And so, you know, things like keynote speaking, masterclasses. I'm very keen to do rent and advisory work rather than consultant work. So I always felt the consultants tell and write reports, and I'd rather go in and help, listen, look, see things, help people move in the framework that they've established rather than what I tell them they need to establish, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll do a bit of one-on-one coaching work as well around leadership and helping people be the best that they can be. And it'll probably be split, you know. Some of it will be in sport and some of it will be in business. But essentially a lot of the lessons that we used in the All Blacks were from business, but business are really poor at instigating a lot of their great theories. there's some real gold in them if you do. So, but yeah, I've got some great opportunities both here and offshore, and I think the challenge will be, you know, trying to find the ones that are cherry pick the ones that I'm really passionate about. A lot of other sports that I've put aside that I love, like skiing and things like that I probably haven't been able to put the time into because rugby's a winter sport. So those I'm pretty keen to chase those. I love sport. I just love the performance space. But yeah, interestingly, I've also just realised in the last month or two with a bit of coaching work, how I love just helping people see who they are and how we can move them, you know, move them on the graph to be better, be it as a leader or just as a person. So yeah, excited actually, really, really looking forward to what it might be. I'm hoping to stay a little bit involved with rugby. I'm going to train to be a match commissioner.
Righto.
Just sort of like the number one official for a match who oversees the whole operation of the match, generally at bigger tournaments like World Cups. So it's an independently appointed person by World Rugby. So I'm doing the training for that. So just I've been on the other side of the fence where I've had to answer to the match commissioner. So I'm pretty familiar with the territory and I know what a good match commissioner is like and what a not so good one's like. So I use that experience to try and be, you know, a really good one. I like the game. You know, I like the people in the game. I like the spirit of the game. I've had the opportunity to see a lot of other sports and don't like what I see in terms of the involvement in them. Just excited about doing those sort of things. Might even help All Black Tours out as an ambassador and go and spend time with the fans and sit on the other side of the fence. I'd love to build a sort of program where I see so much work in high performance around coach development and so little around developing anything else. And I think there's a real need for leadership outside of coaches because I see coaches as technical guys. Yes, they often take the role of the environment and the culture, but I think that needs more than one person's input. We did a bit of assessment on my role and what the manager's role looks like now, and we suddenly realised the bandwidth of it, you know, all the pieces that go into professional sport now, and how can you elevate people to lead? Like, I actually think the term manager's wrong. Yeah. You just ask them to manage stuff. They're a leader, you know, and how do we bring people to that level? How do we share the load between decision-making between coaches and high-performing leaders that looking after the off-field side that are bringing all of those components to it? So we did a whole lot of work on that in New Zealand on the back of the diversity review that was done and found that, you know, there was a shortage in leadership outside of coaching. I'm pretty passionate about trying to give that the light of day and sort of talking to World Rugby about how we can potentially grow people in my role in other countries that don't get the opportunity, you know, to learn and just elevate that level of leadership across the game. So the game's about team, so why not make everything about team, you know?
I was thinking before, poor bugger that has to come in after you and do that role, you know, that it's a beast. It must be a beast for someone who's not done it before.
The Razor's headed down a different path with how he's going to manage that. So they've kind of restructured that space and got a couple of people sort of looking after that whole area. And I really enjoyed the last couple of months after World Cup just being able to share as much as I could because I tell you this wee story about Sam Whitelock. So when I first got told that things were going to change and, you know, I thought I'd do this forever, but I also knew it was kind of time to move too, you know. And Sam goes, I'm going to finish up. This is before the World Cup. And he says, are you going to pass on all your knowledge? I went, no, I won't do that. And he's like, no. You have to, Darren. That's the like way, you know, like we pass, that's the legacy. You got to pass it on. I said, okay, yeah, no, okay. I hear you. And so actually ensured when I finished with New Zealand about my contract, I said, I want 2 months. I want to be fully available to raise this team and I just want to be able to give them everything to help them be successful, you know. I really feel that's important, you know. Then we're in France at the World Cup and the team – for the quarterfinals named, and Sam's wearing number 19. Yeah. And finished Tuesday training, which is when we tell the team who's in. And I could see, I watched him train. You could tell he was, you know, like he was not happy.
Yeah.
And, we're walking back from the training field and just having a chat. And I said, bro, well, you got to get your head up, you know, like, remember that chat you and I had before the World Cup about the All Black way of doing things? I said, for you this week, you're wearing number 19 and you've got to be the best 19 we've ever had because that's what All Blacks do. You know,
yeah.
And you know, I can see the lights going off. You know, you little bugger. You know. Funny enough, I sat with him after the game. I said, oh, who got the player of the match? You know,
yeah.
Number 19 in the team, you know. So, yeah, that's – yeah. I'm so grateful for the opportunity I had. You know, it was never aspired to be the All Black manager. Don't actually really love rugby as a passion, you know. Yet I had that amazing opportunity and everything that I've got now, not just an opportunity, but just in terms of who I became through that experience of being here. So I feel so blessed, actually. It's been good.
Yeah. And finally, because I've kept you for way longer than I should have, do you, I guess you got a couple of challenges, one being that I was thinking, you know, your 25 support staff was, you know, our golf team and a lot of sports teams in New Zealand don't have the financial luxury maybe that the All Blacks do, so that those coaches that you talked about need to have that leadership stuff because they are doing a whole lot of roles within one in many ways. But that's probably another story. How do people get hold of you if there's someone listening that goes, I want to bring Darren into our organization? How do they get in touch? You got a website or anything?
And I have my link. I'm just sort of refining my LinkedIn site shortly, so we'll have that up and running in the next month, and that'll be the place to find me. So going to keep it a bit like, you know, as you introduced me, like, you know, I'm not going to be playing in the big field initially because I've got enough referral work. And time, I think I've got to be able to tell my story, and I'll do that. So,
yeah, and I think that is important. I often say, like you said, it's a bit of a Kiwi way that humble, but there's people out there like yourself and Gilbert and Kerry Evans who, man, they've got so much gold to share, and it is a real treat when you do get to hear people like yourself talk. So I really do appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Jim. I've got a big drive next week from Christchurch to Mount Maunganui with a trailer of surf life-saving equipment, and it's the third time I've done it this year for my daughter who competes. And it's always the performance podcast for the long drive to North Island.
Well, thank you so much for your time, mate. Really do appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thanks. It's always nice to share. So thank you.
Cheers, mate.